Hey, this is Jesse. We're in Michigan City, about to have some breakfast. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Enjoy that breakfast over in Michigan City. Good morning and welcome to Outside the Loop. I am Mike Steven. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. This is show number 903, and Bob Ferguson is our engineer, manning the controls in the WGN radio studio today. So good morning to Bob. And again, I'm happy to be here with you on the program today. Speaking of the program today, we learned the secret history of a Chicago-born bass player who's just played with many of the greats. It's a wonderful story. We'll discuss a new report that came out a few weeks ago about the state of local journalism and how we are in a democracy crisis, and electric vehicles, they could help with reducing pollution, especially in the south and west sides of Chicago, but the infrastructure to charge them is largely non-existent there. And along those lines of transportation, riding public transportation can also help reduce air pollution. Check this out. If you and your friends can muster up $3,000, you can charter your own L train. Yep, if you love the L, but don't love some of the weirdness you inevitably encounter on it, you can rent out a four-car L train and even choose the route it takes. Apparently, this isn't a new thing. According to the CTA, the agency has been chartering trains since the 1930s. A handful of trains are chartered every year for events like fundraisers, wedding receptions, and, of course, pub crawls. However, no booze is allowed on the train. You can even play your own music over the speakers on the L, although the L speakers don't exactly have the most, shall we say, sonic sparkle to them. So that means, out of the well-known mantra that you hear over the sparkly speakers on the L, smoking, drinking, and playing loud music is not allowed on CTA property, is almost true in a charter situation. Anywho, I think it sounds like fun. So if you have $3,000 ready to go and you want to invite the host of the show you're currently listening to, I'd probably go. I'm fun at parties and on the L. Okay, so all that does sound like fun, but what's not fun is the slow death of our democracy. How about that for a transition? Like I said before, today we are going to talk about the crisis of democracy that exists because of the decline of local journalism in our state. There has never been a newspaper strike in Chicago until this past Thursday, when reporters and other newsroom staffers at the Tribune went on a 24-hour strike to demand fair wages and to keep the 401k match benefit. Alden Global Capital purchased the paper in 2021 and apparently plans to bleed the venerable publication dry. Employees at six other Alden-owned papers across the nation were also going on strike this week. Chicago has long been known as a two-paper town, but with Alden at the helm of the Trib, that could seriously be in question. And here's something else. It was announced this week that over 500 journalists across the country lost their jobs in January alone. This is not good. We need trained journalists to be able to speak truth to power. We need an informed electorate, especially during an election year. I mean, this is Chicago and Illinois, after all. We don't exactly have a stellar record when it comes to corruption. But while we ponder how to fix this democracy problem, we could listen to some music. Like I said, we've got you covered when it comes to that on today's show. So get on board that chartered L ride while helping to save the environment because you're using public transportation. Maybe even read a local newspaper while you're there and listen to some local music. I'm all fired up. Can you tell that I've had my coffee this morning? Here we go.
Thank you.
The number of newspapers in Illinois has dropped by more than a third since 2005. Four of the state's 102 counties have no local source of news, and 33 rely on just one source. This is all according to a report published this year from the Illinois Local Journalism Task Force. Mark Jacob is a member of that task force. He's also a member of the Chicago News Guild and former editor at the Tribune and Sun-Times. And he is here with us today to talk all about journalism locally. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. So this is really a crisis of journalism, and there's no way to sugarcoat that. We are in a crisis when it comes to journalism here. So when it comes to the task force, first of all, and how this came to be, what is the task force and what's the origin story here?
Senator Steve Stottleman from the Rockford area, he proposed and passed a bill in the Illinois legislature creating the local journalism task force, and he ended up becoming the chairman of it. And we spent a year studying it and getting guests in, experts, and listening to what they said and coming up with proposals and just studying the whole landscape of, how bad it is and what can be done about it. And one thing I wanted to emphasize is that this is not just a crisis for journalism. This is a crisis for democracy. It's not just a matter of, let's save some people's jobs so they can, because they're journalists. It's a matter of, if you don't have local news, you don't have watchdogs on your government, you don't have people showing up in meetings and finding out, whether they raised your taxes or whether they spent money foolishly or anything like that. Journalism is just incredibly important for, to run a real democracy. And as it's being just chopped to bits here, and it's really these cuts are incredibly dramatic that we've been seeing over the last few decades. As that happens, you just have less engagement of the American public with government.
And so while we're thinking about democracy here and the really important role that journalism plays in democracy, I agree with you, this is a democracy issue. So people are less informed, and that's what we're seeing, less engagement politically and civically. And also, people are just informed by faulty information, because what happens when the mainstream media news outlets, the big outlets, they kind of fade away, or even the local outlets, they go away, then there's this vacuum that's filled by what we see online and the really partisan media, and that is sometimes just false information. That's part of this too.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's not that, that any news organization is perfect. I mean, they all make mistakes, and they all, you might find them too conservative, too liberal, whatever. But professional news outlets, rely on facts. They check things out. They hold people to account. They will look at documents. They will find facts, as opposed to what we see so much in today's news media, which is, just people throwing opinions around, don't have any basis. So if you don't have that, you're in big trouble. There are a lot of studies that have been done about the impact of diminished journalism on a local level. Universities have done studies that have found that areas that have less local journalism have higher indebtedness by their government. In other words, the government's taking on more money, spending more money, and putting the taxpayers, in a worse place. And they also find that voting levels go down. I mean, there are a lot of impacts of this, and so it's important to everyone.
And in addition to the democracy issue, yes, this is a democracy problem, but it is also a business problem. And actually, one of the lines from your report that you issued, this isn't just a business problem, it's a democracy problem too. So we talked about the democracy issue here, but the business side, your report says that the web, the internet, has overrun legacy media. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, I mean, like 25 years ago, newspapers, had a really nice, most of them had a really nice profit margin, and they were selling a lot of classified ads, they were selling a lot of display ads. If you were a business and you wanted to reach a certain type of consumer, you know, you could really target him by, you know, by buying an advertisement in the local news outlet. But as the internet showed up, it, you know, with Craigslist and everything, they took away the classified ads. They, you ended up with a situation where online advertising, digital advertising can target, you know, consumers better than, you know, print newspapers can, you know, because you can, I mean, you can geofencing to find, you could just say, hey, I want people in this particular area. So it's actually more efficient to, in many ways, to advertise online. And so online advertising, it really took away a lot from what these print newspapers were getting. And as newspapers tried to compete, they went free online and lost a lot of money because, you know, you don't make a lot of money going free. And they relied too much on this advertising, which was disappearing. And so it became this trend that was just not sustainable. And so, you know, in the last couple of decades, you've had this erosion of newspaper staffing. You've had a lot of like hedge funds and private equity companies, you know, picking up newspapers. And they're not picking up newspapers because they care about journalism. This right. This is the dangerous thing, is you have these, you have kind of grave robbers in a way. They're people who are just seeing a very diminished product, and they're buying it, and they're trying to squeeze every last cent out of it before they bury it. And that's a dangerous thing, you know, that you don't have people who are in it for the long term. And what you're seeing is Facebook or Google or some other online entity making the advertising bucks off of it, to where you have, you know, some, the news is generated. I mean, there's this weird ecosystem going on now where you have the news is generated by some reporter in some local area. You know, she writes the story. It gets published. Somebody else like picks it up and rewrites it, you know, aggregates it for free, and they put it up, and then somebody sees that and they put it on social media, and, you know, thousands of people read it, and nothing, there's no benefit to the original source of the material. So it's a very cockeyed system we have now, and it's just endangering local journalism overall.
You mentioned the subscription approach, and that is in place throughout many outlets in terms of media and local media. Is that working overall? Can we gauge how that is, how that's going?
It's not really going very well, I don't think. I think, you know, the New York Times is making money, I think, but the Washington Post is losing money. Los Angeles Times just laid off, you know, a lot of journalists. So overall, that's not working. Maybe the new, more hopeful trend is nonprofit journalism, where you're seeing these foundations pay a lot of money, they give money to local news outlets to try to keep them going. And you also have these efforts like Black Globe Chicago is a, you know, terrific local outlet, and it's online only and it's nonprofit. And they get, the people love it so much that they don't necessarily have to subscribe. They're more like members than subscribers. They give money because they want it, sustain it because they value it. And so that kind of trend where people support a nonprofit news entity is that there's some hope there, but the subscription thing, we're just going to have to see. It may work for some news outlets on a very low level. I mean, to where their staffs are extremely diminished, but they still manage to survive.
So in terms of what we can do here, because in this report, you make it very clear that we need to act right now. This is something that we can't just sit around and ponder too much. We have got to take some action here. So I know that in this report, you outline a bunch of things that we could do. But just at the top of your list here, what is something that we could do pretty quickly here that could make a difference?
Well, I mean, a lot of this, we were thinking of more like, you know, government approaches. You know, obviously we're not talking about, you know, people doing bake sales. We're talking about government, the state government primarily coming up with ways to, you know, to support local journalism. And yet the problem is urgent and getting worse. And, you know, as we were writing the report, the Southern Illinois and in Carbondale, you know, fired its entire, you know, union staff. I mean, mm-hmm. It got sold and then they fired him. So it's, you know, it's a 5-alarm fire right now. Now, some of the things that can be done, we've talked about tax credits, you know, which would be people who subscribe to news outlets could apply for a tax credit. which would be an incentive that would probably increase the number of subscriptions. We've talked about advertising tax credits, where businesses that advertise in local news outlets would get a tax credit for that. And we've also talked about payroll tax credits, where news outlets would be incentivized to hire and retain new journalists because they would get a tax credit based on how many staffers they had. There have been attempts to get Google and Facebook and, you know, all the big tech folks to share with the local news outlets. And obviously they don't want to give away money. So that's become kind of a struggle. And there was even, in some cases, like Facebook has, you know, threatened to take local news outlets off of, you know, just not put news on there or not put certain outlets on if that kind of thing happens. So that's good. We've talked about that in the report, but that is kind of, it would get us a lot of money for local news, but it also would be probably a huge court fight and might take, you know, a years of struggle. So that's something to look at. And that's also have been on the national level in Congress, that's been talked about too, that you could, right now, news outlets cannot get together to try to negotiate with big tech because that violates antitrust laws. And so there has been talk in Congress of giving them a waiver on antitrust so that they could all get together and confront Google and Facebook and ask them to share the money, since Google and Facebook are in effect making money off the work of local journalists.
Well, what we do know here is that this is a serious problem. And in this report, there are a bunch of solutions like you were talking about, Mark. And we will link up to this report from the Illinois Local Journalism Task Force. This is such an important issue. Democracy is at stake. We need our free press, and we have to preserve our free press into the future. Mark Jacob is a member of the Illinois Local Journalism Task Force, also a member of the Chicago News Guild and former editor at the Tribune and Sun-Times. Mark, I really appreciate the time and all of your work on this super important issue, and really keep doing what you're doing because we need the efforts.
Well, thanks for bringing a spotlight to it. I really appreciate it.
Out and about on the roads these days, maybe you are seeing more and more electric vehicles, also known as EVs. EVs have the potential to reduce air pollution, especially if they are used in neighborhoods that have faced health problems as a result of disproportionate air pollution. There are areas on the south and west sides of Chicago that fit this bill. Communities where industry is placed sometimes over the objections of the residents. EVs could help here, but there needs to be more EV infrastructure for those vehicles. Jose Miguel Acosta Cordova is the Transportation Justice Program Manager at the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. They are online at lvejo.org, and he is here with us today. Jose, welcome to Outside the Loop. Nice to have you here.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So these areas of Chicago that I mentioned, these neighborhoods, these areas tend to be where people of color are living. They tend to be low income, and they're, you know, it seems that industry, Chicago's industry is, and I should say rail, is in these neighborhoods, and it's really having a health impact here. So can you give us an example here? For example, the Little Village neighborhood, what does this look like specifically when we talk about having industry in these neighborhoods? What's going on here?
Yeah, so I guess to put things into perspective, right, a lot of these areas on the south and west sides have been industrial for a very long time, you know, some as many as 100 and, you know, close to 150 years, right? So, I mean, these are the historical industrial neighborhoods of Chicago, many of which were once working class white, have since become primarily black and brown communities. So, you know, we actually have 26 official industrial corridors in Chicago, and all the largest of the industrial corridors are all located on the south and west sides. So, you know, the largest is the southeast side, the Calumet. In Little Village, we're actually, we have the third largest industrial corridor. So it's about 1,252 acres of the total, you know, South Lawndale community area that's dedicated to industry. And essentially the way it works is if a property is located within this industrial corridor, it's given priority for industrial zoning. Industrial projects are prioritized in these parts of the community. In Little Village, we had this recent battle over the Hilco warehouse, for example, right? The former Crawford coal plant. Mm-hmm. Because it was located in the industrial corridor, it was a lot easier for the company to get their approvals on the zoning and on the project overall, as well as getting the support of local politicians and the city itself, right? Because at the end of the day, when we live in a capitalist society, you know, economic development and the jobs that are promised with those kinds of developments or with these, you know, industrial developments are prioritized and often approved and often at the expense of our local environment. So, we have a huge freight sector, for example, where we are the freight hub of North America. So we have more rail yards than any other part of the country. We have more rail infrastructure than any other part of the country. We have more industrial development dedicated to freight, right? All the additional operations that are associated with the movement of goods. And we have more transportation, distribution, and logistics companies than any other part of the country. So freight is a huge part of our sector. I think it's been estimated that 1 in 4 jobs in the region are in some way related to the movement of goods. So again, it's a huge part of our economy, but it also has many negative impacts. And air pollution, of course, is the most pressing of those impacts.
Mm-hmm. So this issue here of a lack of electric vehicle infrastructure in these communities on the south and west sides of Chicago, can you give us a sense of why this is a big deal? What does this mean for these communities?
Yeah, so, given that the south and west sides, by all the data and all the data has been collected and produced, right, the south and west sides have the worst air pollution. So when we're talking about trying to reduce the air pollution through the use of electric vehicles, not having charging infrastructure is a major barrier. And it's one of several barriers, right, that we've been highlighting in some of the work. But particularly when we talk about medium and heavy duty vehicles, right, those diesel powered trucks that are disproportionately impacting our communities, not having the charging infrastructure for them is a major barrier to often something that they use to justify a slow transition to electric or to zero emission, medium and heavy duty vehicles. So that's from the commercial side. And of course, medium and heavy duty vehicles also includes buses, right? Transit buses, school buses, the single unit vehicles as well. Things like trash trucks and the garbage trucks and stuff like that. So that from the commercial standpoint, right? That's what our biggest concern is, given the impact that it's having on Black and Brown communities. But then from the passenger vehicle side, right? For those who do want to be able to purchase an electric vehicle, and who want to feel like they're committing, they're trying to help make some change and reducing at least their own impacts on our air pollution. Not having that charging infrastructure is really the key barrier that's stopping them from being able to purchase a vehicle.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to look at where these charging stations, and that's what we're talking about here. So if you don't know, electric vehicles, instead of putting gasoline in there, you need to recharge the battery. And so to do that, you need charging stations. And there just aren't any charging stations, or very few, I should say, in these communities on the south and west sides of Chicago. So how do you refuel, essentially? How do you recharge the batteries? This is something that obviously, people can install charging stations in their homes, but that costs money. And I think it was only recently that the Chicago City Council said all new buildings need to have a space for charging stations, residential buildings. But that's as of 2020, so not too many have those. So what we're looking at here is a system where we say, hey, use electric vehicles. Let's cut down on the air pollution, but there's no place to recharge these cars. So in terms of what we can do to be better here, to fix this problem, what ideas do you have? What can the city do to alleviate this, to maybe install more charging stations in these communities?
You know, so there's, you know, there's things happening at the city level as well as the state level, right? And there is going to be some money coming through the state through different programs like the VW settlement money, and some other money that should be coming through the IEPA and through state agencies. But so there is going to be some efforts, or there are efforts now being put into providing that charging infrastructure. But from a city level, right, it's really key that that money then goes to the areas that need it the most, right? And as you pointed out, right, this map that's been created through the Black Club article that was written, right, shows how, you know, just many neighborhoods in the South and West sides don't even have a charger at all, or they have, you know, one area where there's a charger. For example, in Little Village, we have one area where there's a charger in the southwestern part of the neighborhood. So it's going to be key that those efforts are then put towards the areas that really need it, right, and providing that infrastructure. Another key issue is the fact that the majority of Chicagoans do not own their own home, right, and often with charging infrastructures, it's placed in, you know, people who have EVs are able to charge their vehicles because they have their infrastructure within their own garage, right, and when you live in a multi-unit building, where there is no garage and you have to use street parking, right, just that option of charging your vehicle is just not there, especially if then there's nowhere else in your neighborhood where you can charge it as well. So I think, you know, these kinds of things have to really be considered. There's also a state law that just went through that's requiring new buildings to be EV ready and EV have the EV capacity. So I think there are efforts now happening that hopefully could tackle this issue of, you know, inequity in where charging infrastructure is located. But we need to really, you know, the city really needs to make sure that it's putting those necessary resources to those areas that don't currently have any infrastructure at all.
Are you optimistic that that can happen, that the city and maybe even the state, as you say, can do that, that maybe we can get some money to these areas that would love to do something? Because again, this pollution is negatively impacting the well-being and the health of these residents. Are you optimistic that that can happen?
I am optimistic. I think, you know, it's been documented and you know, and CDOT, for example, has really committed to trying to increase their overall importance of environmental justice in a lot of their transportation work, right? And this is definitely included in that. So I'm definitely optimistic. I think we have some really good folks, you know, obviously at VEJO, but many of our allies who are working on this issue, who are bringing awareness and really calling out the inequities and how this development has happened. The other thing we need also be considerate of is the cost of EVs, right? And you are starting to see, you know, EVs be somewhat more affordable. You know, there's now more of a used market for EVs, but it's still not to where it needs to be. And that's where we really need to get to, you know, and that's, you know, that's a larger issue within the industry, right, is making sure that these new EVs that are coming out are more affordable. I mean, for example, you know, I would love to buy that new Chevy Silverado EV, but, you know, $100,000 for a new truck, you know, yeah, that's not really doable for most people. And that goes for a lot of the vehicles. So I think that's really another really critical aspect is the cost of the EVs.
Well, this is an issue that we will keep an eye on. And it's to a larger issue, I think, of environmental justice in Chicago. And this topic is not new, and many communities, especially on the south and west sides of the city, have experienced negative health impacts because of the pollution and, as you say, Jose, the inequities that exist in this topic. So we should all check out LVEJO.org for the Little Village Environmental Justice Organization. Jose Miguel Acosta Cordova is the Transportation Justice Program Manager for that organization. Jose, thank you so much for talking to us about this issue today, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm excited. I think there's a lot of really good things on the horizon from the local level to the national level, so hopefully we can solve this issue and get these polluting vehicles off our road. So thank you.
Occasionally in the Chicago Reader, you will see the column, The Secret History of Chicago Music. It is hand-drawn by local musician, music historian, and artist Plastic Crime Wave. He's also known as Steve Krakow. This strip profiles a local musician or a band who never quite made it to the big time. So right now, let's dim those lights. Let's fire up the old hi-fi as we travel to Chicago's Ukrainian Village neighborhood and enter
The Secret History of Chicago Music.
Oh, she didn't bat an eye as I packed my bags to leave. Thought she would start to cry.
Oh yeah, once again connecting across town to the lair of an apartment of one Mr. Steve Krakow, the author of The Secret History of Chicago Music Strip, in the Chicago Reader, and also music historian and artist and musician himself. And this week, Steve, we enter back into the winter blues and we learn about this Renaissance man. He is a great bass player, and his name is Bernard Reed. What a dude.
Yeah, you know, like as I kind of started off, it's like I hesitated even to put him in Winter Blues, you know, feature, because, you know, that's how he is mostly known these days as a bluesman, but like, he's worn so many hats throughout his career, and probably the stuff he's most famous for is not necessarily the blues.
Right. So we'll talk about how Bernard Reed has played with everyone. I feel like we say this, but so many of these folks who never get top billing, I feel like they've played with all the greats and then some.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, obviously it's a cliche, the bass player doesn't always get the love, you know, unless you're like Les Claypool slapping on that thing, you know, and you're like a virtua, or you're, you know, the singer song, you know, you're like Phil Lynott of Thin Lizzy or something. It's like you're the bass player, but you're also the front man and the singer and you know, the songwriter, and then people take notice. But not so much if you know you're holding down that groove. It's so important. And you're writing grooves that are important.
That's right. The power and importance of the bass player must not be underestimated, because really important job in the band. I don't know how to say this. I think I've talked about this before. I feel like the bass player is always the wild card, though, even though the person's got the groove. Like, it's always the bass player is going to say something funny or just kind of look at you weird or be a little off the beaten path. That's the bass player, I find.
We've discussed this phenomena, and I'll just say, out of any other kind of musicians in my bands, I've definitely had the most weird relations with bass players. I will definitely say that, you know, there's complexes in being a bass player. You know, you're important, but you kind of want to hang back and just hold down the groove, and you're cool with that. And I think maybe somewhere in between those two things, something happens. But Bernard Reed seems like a well-adjusted virtuoso bass player.
He seems like a nice guy. Bernard Reed, born in Chicago on May 22nd, 1945. He grew up on the west side of the city. When he's in high school, he's learning the sousaphone. I mean, I don't know if that's an instrument that's going by the wayside here, but maybe more of us should look into the sousaphone, you know?
Not a name on the lips of a nation. How about we'll say that?
That's,
you know,
right.
Not a word that you hear come out of many people's mouths these days. No, and it's interesting, too. His brother was I could probably do a whole column on him, because he was a really amazing and important guitar player and musician as well. But they grew up, it was sort of described as one big family that lived in two different neighborhoods and homes. So his brother actually grew up on the north side, and he grew up on the west side, technically, because I guess his grandparents just sort of took a shine to him, you know, Bernard, they really liked him. So they're like, he grew up in, you know, and maybe it was too much for one household. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I feel like that's another thing that's not necessarily done
much anymore.
So he is going to pick up the bass, and he is playing school events, talent shows, and eventually he's going to play bigger spots, but it's kind of like an upward glide here. As he gets older, he is eventually going to also get on some recordings, although it's not right away.
Yeah, it was a journey, for sure. Like, you know, his bandmate in his doo-wop group, the Constellations, tutored him on some bass. You know, he was kind of still learning, it sounded like, you know, for a little while there. And then he saw Bobby Blue Bland, try and say that five times fast, doing Turn On Your Love Light, which, you know, classic song, so many bands, and very classic bass line. And he was like, okay, I'm going to learn that, you know? So he kind of started with that after seeing him at the Regal Theater, which the Constellations ended up playing, which big place to play, in the day. And then, yeah, the Constellations sort of got absorbed, as studio musicians for big labels. I mean, this could just happen. They were kids, you know, they're so young. And like Chess, Smash Records, Roulette, which is run by like gangsters.
Right.
Curious about that. Yeah. Literally made roulette wheels too. And might have hung like Tommy James out of a window at some point or something, you know, like that level. So yeah, they're doing all these like sessions, for these labels and, you know, seeing the absolute best session people in the world, you know, Phil Upchurch playing guitar and bass, Lewis Satterfield, you know, who played on like Earth, Wind and Fire stuff, who, and Johnny Pate, you know, who like arranged, you know, the impressions and all the, you know, like they basically, you know, can you imagine just being a kid and sort of like witnessing the like absolute best, you know, of like, in this case, soul, you know, and R&B at work, you know, and you're just these kids doing like background vocals, basically.
And he's playing Bernard Reed on bass. He's going to play, like we said before, with so many people. And yes, these great musicians are coming through. If you are a side musician, you get to experience all that. But he's playing with the Shy Lights, Jackie Wilson, Betty Everett, Gene Chandler, Ramsey Lewis, and more. He's playing with all these guys.
Yeah, his brother kind of got him foot in the door, Danny. He came back from a big tour with Major Lance, who had a huge hit, Monkey Time, which was a Curtis Mayfield song. And came back, joined this group, The Artistics, who I covered in an old Secret History. And a lot of guys moved through that group. And Bernard Reed was drafted on bass. And that was basically his foot in the door to becoming like the in-demand bass guy. And I mean, he's playing on Soulful Strut.
Yeah. That incredibly popular song.
Incredibly popular song. And this was interesting. I didn't even include it. He wrote the bass line for Higher and Higher by Jackie Wilson.
Really?
But actually Lewis Satterfield performed it because he was like out of town or something.
So, all right, that gets us into the 1970s. He's playing with, I mean, the list here. Aretha Franklin, Natalie Cole. He's the Deacons with Syl Johnson's big brother, Jimmy. The list goes on here. It's insane. And so he is, you know, this is interesting.
In different genres, too.
Right, right. I want to ask you about that.
And jazz, funk, gospel, blues, you know, and then he sort of crossed over. He's played on some Howlin' Wolf sessions, and that sort of brought him into the blues.
Right. And so where does this take him then, 70s into the 80s? Because we should say that he is a living legend here in 2024, Bernard Reed. How do we get to present day?
Well, he took a break in the 80s. Like a lot of guys, I think he got kind of disenchanted with the business, and I think blues was, you know, kind of at a low for sort of like appreciation too, you know, for people too. So he took a break for some years and then sort of came back in the 90s and played with, like, I didn't even realize I saw him play with Screamin' Jay Hawkins.
Wow.
And Chicago Blues Fest was 96. I was like, what year was that? Oh my God, I just moved. I moved to Chicago in 95. So I was like, damn, I was on it. Good job. You know, I got myself down there and I made sure I saw that. And I remember he brought out the toilet, did constipation blues. He did all the props. He came out of the coffin. You know, I mean, yeah. I was still pretty far back, but I did not realize I was in. But so, you know, backed him. It's like a who's who, you know, like Mighty Joe Young, Swamp Dog, Otis Clay, Magic Slim, Eddie the Chief Clearwater. So yeah, he became like sort of had like a third act, fourth act, whatever it is, you know, as a like super in demand blues bassist, and played like all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, literally all over the world, which is amazing. So possibly this year, could he get back out? Could we see Bernard Reed on stage playing the bass?
It's possible. I saw him in 2022 and I didn't realize that exactly either. He was playing with this another legend who I covered Secret History a long time ago, Willie Henderson, who did a couple records himself, but famed mostly as a producer. And he had this thing called the Big Bad Blues Band. And yeah, he was playing bass, and that was 2022.
All right. Well, hopefully this year we can catch Bernard Reed on stage. He is playing the bass, and he is featured in this week's Secret History of Chicago music strip in the Chicago Reader. Steve Krakow is the author of that strip. He also hand draws whoever he is profiling, so you could go to chicagoreader.com or pick up a copy of the Reader. And Steve is an artist, local musician, music historian, and we love him, and he loves music. We all love music. Steve, it's winter blues, my man, although it was like 50 or something this week, but that's okay.
And we got warm, supple bass tones.
From the day I laid my eyes on you, I knew, girl, you were my dream come true. I tried so hard not to confess that you were the only one to ensure my happiness.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 903 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. I appreciate it. I appreciate Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering help today in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.